Tonight we welcome John Lamlash back to wrap up our talk on the occult roots of the Russian Revolution. For any who don't know, John's website is metahistory.org, and the link to this site is on the show website, right there on the front of the website. When you go onto middlechamberfx.com, there's the date. If you, you know, drag your mouse cursor over to that date, there's a link. You click on that, it links right to metahistory.org, but there's also a link on the website that's been there since we launched this site that'll take you to metahistory.org. Take the virtual tour there, guided by John himself. Also, you can, if you, you know, go out and pick up a copy of his amazing book, which is Not in His Image. It's just so pertinent. It really is something that ever since I've read the book, I've told everyone I know that it's one of the most important books of our time. So I highly recommend this book. And look for John all over the web, interviewed on many shows, most of which are posted on RadioTeleste.org. He's on YouTube. You can just Google search John Lamlash, and you'll have many, many hours of information at your fingertips after that. Now, we've spent several shows examining the occult roots of the Russian Revolution, and it's been over time, and we just wanted to give this final show is the one we want to kind of wrap it up. Once again, it is my signature honor and privilege to welcome my friend and co-conspirator John Lamlash into the Middle Chamber. Greetings, John. How are you?
Greetings over there. Just fine. Lovely. Delightful.
Excellent. We had some initial issues with connectivity, but I'm glad we got you on board here for the conference call.
I think we're solid. Yeah.
Great. Well, it's been a little while since we spoke. You've been busy, I take it.
Well, the Gaia navigation experiment, as I call it, occupies the greater part of my attention, and that's forging ahead really strongly right now. So it's an exciting moment, a really, really critical moment in the history of the human species, the spring of 2012. Here we are.
And we are back live, Radio Free Humanity in the Middle Chamber with John Lamlash. I'm Freighter X. We're going to conclude our conversation that's been going on for several weeks now, looking closely at the occult roots of the Russian Revolution. And we had a little bit of technical difficulties the first segment. We've got everything all taken care of now. So here we go. And John, I want you to just feel free to take us, you know, bring us up to speed and take it away.
Thank you, Frederick. Those of you who've been following these talks would do well to listen to them in continuity, because I've tried to develop over the previous three talks some consistent themes regarding parallels and correlations, if you will, between the Russian Revolution and what is currently happening in the United States. So I'm not going to go over the parallels that I've already mentioned. You can listen to them or pick them up in the previous talks. I'd like to focus on two things this evening. I'd like to describe one more parallel, which is remarkable and deeply, deeply frightening, a parallel between the developments before, during, and after the Russian Revolution and the current developments in the United States in the atmosphere of civil uprising. And secondly, most importantly, Frederick and I decided that we would dedicate this last talk to the spiritual background of the Russian Revolution, to its Gnostic and even Sophianic foundations, which are absolutely tremendous and something that I believe would be most enlightening for us to understand today in regard to the challenge that we ourselves are now facing. So if that makes sense to you, Frederick, we'll proceed with that agenda. Hello?
Yes, John. Okay, so we'll go ahead and we'll forge ahead with this new ground that I really think is exciting. It's a bold and new look that you don't hear a lot of anywhere else.
No, this is a pretty unique approach, and I think this parallel between the Russian Revolution and the American Revolution, as I said, can be very helpful in steering current events in the right direction, or at the very least, having a more grounded understanding of what's going on here. History is repeating itself, as it's known to do, and we don't want to repeat the mistakes of history, so we look at what went wrong in the previous scenarios. The one parallel that I'd like to point out this evening to kick us off is the parallel of surveillance. I think everybody knows what that word means these days, you know, surveillance. I haven't been in the States for a while, but I understand that there's a tremendous amount of surveillance going on from all angles. And I heard recently that there's a plan to introduce 30,000 drones to surveil the American population. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, this is crazy. That it's a certain weight limit. They got to go under a certain weight limit, and they're okay in our territory, supposedly.
Right, and we also hear stories about the DHS and other agencies already having tested these miniature dragonfly-sized surveillance devices, which they have used to fly in formation over certain events, such as the Occupy movement events, in order to photograph people and keep their eye on the dissidents and so forth.
Yeah, so, you know, and there's there's some analysis that's been out there. Freeman's taken a look at the chemtrail emissions and the particles that he says that are saturating us all. One of them is barium, he says, found in the chemtrails that we're absorbing into our bodies. And when we gather in these areas, like these occupation movements or other gatherings of human beings, these drones are programmed to read the barium levels in gatherings of humans. That's pretty creepy.
Yeah, we hear a lot of stories. One thing is certain, whatever can be confirmed or not, we've reached a science fiction level of extravagance in regard to the surveillance to which the American population, especially, and the world population in general, is being subjected to. But it's really the American population, because America is the frontier of freedom and always will be, always has been. And America is the place where it's make it or break it. America is the place where the global revolution makes it or breaks it. If freedom cannot be defended in the United States of America, it can't be defended anywhere. This is my particular view anyway. So I just want to point out that previous to the Stalinist era, you had the tyrannical and largely Christian fundamentalist domination of the Tsar. You had the reign of the Russian Tsar, which he had reigned for about 1,000 years from the conversion of Russia to Christianity in the 10th century, so-called conversion. That is to say, from the political expediency when Christianity was adopted as part of the state, as part of the superpersonal state, as a vehicle of domination and control. That was in the 10th century in Russia, and then for 1,000 years it developed, and it developed massively. At the time of the last Russian Tsar, the Russian Empire was greater than the Roman Empire, and it was probably the greatest organized political, social, religious tyranny that ever existed on the face of the earth to that moment. It was the precursor of the global New World Order system of total control from the top down, of the pyramidal control structure. And part and parcel of the Tsar's operations was the Okhrana, or the Secret Service. And so up to the eve of the revolution in 1917, there was already in place an enormous network of spies all through the Russian Empire. And what happened when the Bolsheviks took over the revolution, when they co-opted the popular revolution, and in the service of the international bankers, took it over. They were the Bolsheviks were the controlled opposition. They took it over and commandeered the revolution and turned it into the nightmare that it became under Stalin. They totally appropriated, expanded, and advanced the Okhrana, and that's how they created the KGB. And the extent of the surveillance in Stalinist Russia is beyond imagination. It's like where we're getting today with Homeland Security and Big Sis Janet Napolitano. We're getting to the same level in the United States. The main key to the success of surveillance in the Stalinist era was having citizens spy on each other. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, absolutely. John, can I stop you for just a moment, too, and to kind of set the stage here? The political atmosphere on the street at this time during the ends, the totalitarian system before the KGB, during the Okhrana, wasn't it flooded with wasn't a very literate culture, a very literate society of citizenry, correct? And there was a lot of publications, a lot of opinion, editorial papers being passed around in the streets of Russia at this time, wasn't there?
Well, there was a lot, yes, Writer X, but in a way it was only a minuscule portion of the Russian populace as such. And I can explain in two sentences why that was so. The pyramidal New World Order structure of the Tsarist state was so massive, so totalitarian, and so massively enforced that it virtually broke the Russian people into two sections. One section was the serfs, which is a great majority of people, and they actually lived in serfdom. They were slaves, and they lived in a state of medieval feudalism or worse, and they were reduced to extremely deplorable conditions of servitude. As some people say, the New World Order masterminds would like to reduce the world population today. We hear this claim all the time. We hear that we are under that threat. So the great majority of Russian people, if you're speaking numbers, were serfs. Then at the top of the pyramid was the Tsar's family and the military who supported the Tsar, the Tsar's army, which was like the enforcement arm, just like we have today the feds in the United States at the top of the pyramid of social control. And between these two was a layer. And this layer was absolutely critical. You are right. There was a great many publications, a great many pamphlets, a great many different societies in St. Petersburg, in Moscow, and elsewhere, who were composed of enlightened and progressive individuals, the intellectuals and the Russian intelligentsia. But they were not large in number, you understand, but they were very, very large in voice and very, very large in their influence. But they were a tiny layer, as it were, inserted between the capstone of the pyramid, which was the command and control of the Tsarist regime, and the massive amount of serfs and ordinary people. That would be, I think, the more accurate picture.
Okay, John, are you still there?
Yeah, sure.
All right, great. I think you blanked out for a second there, but basically you've made it clear that there was the dichotomy of the two distinct classes, which is we're moving towards a very familiar scenario here in our culture today.
Yeah, we can see what happened with the destruction of the middle class in the United States. You know, it's well known that one of the goals of the of the New World Order masterminds, let's just call them this, the globalist controllers, is to destroy the middle class in the United States, right?
Yeah, and, you know, there's been a subtle shift in my lifetime. When I was a child, I remember hearing about the great disparity in the governments in South and Central America and how, you know, the separation of wealth and how there was the upper rich and then way below was the poverty-stricken poor, the general population. And they made that distinction like that's what it's like there and it's not here in America that way. When I was a young boy, I remember that very clearly.
Well, me as well, but it's certainly much closer to that now, and we can see many, many things since the era of the Kennedy assassination, which are driving America toward this state, and many things which contribute to the intentionally and deliberately, systematically contribute to the destruction of the working class. For instance, the offshore location of work, taking work and industry out of the United States deliberately, is a move against the American people, deindustrialization of the United States. And as many commentators have remarked, it does seem as if the globalist controllers, those who would be gods of this world, are pushing for this feudal system in which there is a capstone group of a very small elite, and then there is beneath them the feudal order of the serfs. And they would even like to reduce that feudal order from some 7 billion down to less than a billion. So we're in a situation where there is now a globalist conspiracy of psychopathic control freaks who are trying to push the entire world into a situation that closely resembles the situation Russia was in at the eve of the Russian Revolution.
Wow. I mean, I think we're painting a clear picture, and we're just about to come up on a break. So when we come back, we'll continue to bring this back up to our contemporary views of our culture today and talk about, you know, that why is this significant? Why are we looking at the occult roots of the Russian Revolution and trying to bridge the gap between then and now? Here at Radio Free Humanity, this is Freighter X talking with John Lash, and we are continuing our conversation, the conclusion of our talk on the occult roots of the Russian Revolution, and we're moving right along here. John, if you'd like to pick it back up, I think we're making good progress, all things considered, with our technical difficulties.
Sure. Before we proceed, I'd like to make one point, just a point of advice or suggestion, you might say, concerning the method by which we come to terms with the challenge of our time. You know, the Russian Revolution wasn't so long ago. It was only about 100 years ago, less actually. And I just like to point out something. This is not telling people what to do, but it's a suggestion that I consider extremely important. There's a tendency among many people today who are investigating what's happening globally, especially the machinations and orchestrations of the global elite, so-called, of the psychopathic controllers, there's a tendency to go way, way, way back into the past and go down all these different rabbit holes and trails and go into the labyrinth of the Templars and the ancient history and origin of the Jesuits and origin of the Freemasons and to go back and look at Egyptian history and to go way, way back into the remote past to try to understand and get a bearing on what's happening today so that we can better defend human freedom and make a way of life on Earth in mutual aid inspired by the human spirit. And I'm of the opinion that it is not necessary to go back that far at all. In fact, I'm of the opinion that's a very serious mistake to go back that far, and that people who go back that far make a lot of mistakes because they don't have a sufficient grasp of ancient history, and they make false correlations and associations. The time is so urgent right now. We don't have enough time left in this critical moment to go back down those ancient rabbit holes. We just don't. And that is why I consider this retrospective of a century looking back to the Russian Revolution to be much, much more powerful and effective. I believe it will teach us much more of what we need to know today to meet the challenge of surveillance, of controlled opposition, and of the other parallels that we've seen between the Russian Revolution and the current uprising. I also believe that the impact of our empathy with the Russian people in their situation will rebound back to us and will give us increased moral force and moral vision to face the oppression today. You know, some years ago, about 30, I guess, a historian named Barbara Tuchman, T-U-C-H-M-A-N, wrote a fantastic book called A Distant Mirror. I don't know if you've ever heard of that book.
No, I haven't.
It's a very good history book if you want to read history. The premise of that book was she went back to the 14th century, which, by the way, was the century of the Black Plague in Europe.
Sure, and many things happened in the 14th century. Huh?
And many things happened. in the 14th century, which were a mirror of the beginning of the 20th century. So Barbara Tuchman used this idea, a distant mirror. But she didn't go back to the ancient mysteries. The people who talk about the ancient mysteries today, largely, especially those who attribute the them as being the source or origin of the Illuminati, are completely off the mark, completely, and very misleading. We don't have to go back to the 14th century. The Russian Revolution can be our mirror, and it can be a tremendous way to look at ourselves and to come to terms with the situation today. So I just want to point out that little point of method and explain why I put such an emphasis on this and why I don't believe we need to go back so far into history to get our bearings today.
So John, you're making a great point here, John. Let's take a moment more and think about it too. I mean,
sure.
What you've said is really powerful, because I have to admit, I am susceptible to that urge to trace things back, you know, through the ancient millennia, back to the ancient beginnings, and I've fallen into that myself. And you're absolutely right. There's not enough time in my life to read the books I've surrounded myself with. And it's almost like a little bit of an obsession, I have to admit. But you know, the fact of the matter is that the changes that have impacted our modern life have occurred within the last 100, 150 years. And it is a dynamic experience, this social change. We see the movement and how fast things can, you know, come about, and how fast the unfolding of events can lead to drastic upheavals. And it all can happen within a small lifetime. You know, so I can see what you're saying. It's very important, I think, for us all to consider that we really can focus in the last couple hundred years to look for the what's going on and where our solutions are to be found.
Absolutely, and especially when it comes to the matter of the Illuminati, if you want to use that stock term and say, well, the Illuminati is kind of the seed group of sinister, manipulative, and deceitful people who are trying to, you know, take over the world. Well, we need to understand the Illuminati, but I swear to you, you do not have to go back before 1740 to understand the Illuminati. If you go back to 1740, 1750, or the era of the French and American revolutions, and come forward, you can understand every single thing that is wrong today, and every single institution and organization that needs to be overturned to bring the world back to mutual aid and individual sovereignty. Many of the researchers who've done that work have done excellent work. I won't name any names, but you know who they are. But when those same researchers drop back in more distant time, they lose the plot entirely. And we don't have time to go back and speculate about what happened in the Egyptian mysteries. Doesn't matter. What matters is what has happened in the last 250 years. We can catch up with ourselves in that time frame. We cannot catch up with ourselves in that expanded time frame. It becomes an indulgence and a distraction, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, John, it's really a great point. Yeah, it's a great point. All right. So
let's proceed.
Yes.
Yeah. We pointed out that in the pyramidal structure of the Tsarist regime, which was massive, there was a thin membrane of the population, which was the aristocracy and the Russian intelligentsia. This is the key word. The Russian intelligentsia, at the time of the Russian Revolution, just under a century ago, played an enormously critical role. And what we might ask ourselves today is, where is the equivalent of the Russian intelligentsia in American culture? You know, or do we even have an intellectual class?
John, before we go there, because I do have some points I'd like to bring up with you, and we've only got 3 minutes until the next break. Can we continue before we go into that part of this talk?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's just kind of sidestep that point for a moment, because I want to be able to...
Okay, we'll pick...
That.
Okay. Okay. So as I was saying, I might just take this opportunity to give you a few references if you want to go look at the Russian Revolution. There are many books on the Russian Revolution. Just choose one that's not too heavy and not too dense, a brief one that can give you an overview. But also, it's very essential to read Toward the Finland Station by Edmund Wilson. Fantastic book, beautifully written book about the build-up to the Russian Revolution. And finally, this really, really good book called The Occult in Russian and Soviet Culture. And it's edited by Bernice Rosenthal. It's published by Cornell University Press. This is a mind-boggling book. When you see the occultism, and I mean that in the positive sense, that is the quest for the hidden knowledge about humanity and about our potential as a species. That's what occultism really is. Unfortunately, the word is used in a tainted way, speciously associated with Satanism and things like that. The occult is the study of our own true potential. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. The problem with the occult is that there have been some people who have studied the occult who have understood what makes humans tick, how they can be programmed, and understood the deeper secrets of human nature, and have used it for control. So that is the wrong use of the occult. But the occult in itself is neither right nor wrong. It is just the knowledge of what is hidden from us, of what is latent in human potential. And we desperately need to have that knowledge in order to face the people who, on their side, use that against us.
And we see the evidence of those who would use occult knowledge and symbolisms against the populace in areas like media, pop culture, advertising. There was a whole show before this show tonight where Freeman talked about the Madonna halftime show during the Super Bowl, which was like chock full of paganistic occult symbolism, and everybody's speculating as to the meanings and all this. And you know, the most simplest explanation is that I think we as a species respond to these symbols, and the advertisers and the media know that. And so, you know, just flashing them at us is going to get our attention. You know, just that simple flashing the image.
Just because they use those symbols, like of a.
Okay, John, well, this is our break. When we come back, we'll continue this fascinating conversation with John Lash, Occult Roots of the Russian Revolution. Now, on with the show this evening, our fascinating talk with John Lem Lash concerning the occult roots of the Russian Revolution. And before we went to the break, we were discussing, we discussed some works that you might want to take a look at that would be referenced to the subjects we're covering here. One of them was The Occult in Russian and Soviet Culture by which is edited or compiled by Bernice Rosenthal. This is, according to John, a book that is really edifying to anyone interested in these subjects. So I'm sure that's one that you can find with a little search either on the internet or through your library system if that's available to you. But having said that, John, if you want to continue, we can go ahead and take it from here.
Sure. I'll give an example of some of the mind-blowing things that you'll find in this book, The Occult in Russian Soviet Culture. In one of the essays, the author points out that Maxim Gorky, who was a playwright and Russian intellectual and key figure in the revolution, formulated in 1919 an idea that seems to anticipate the concept of the noosphere. Quote, Gorky wrote, "Besides the atmosphere and the photosphere, our entire planet is enveloped by a sphere of spiritual creation, a manifold iridescent emanation of our very own energies," end quote. Now, just imagine that. That was 1919.
Oh, that's okay.
Isn't that astounding? We think today that, and we justly so, rightly so, that people talk about the noosphere and about the awakening of the planetary consciousness itself and about humanity as a cellular presence in the planetary consciousness are talking in the most avant-garde mode. But the Russians were talking about this 100 years ago.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and it was part of the ferment of the revolution. So what I'd like to focus on right now, very quickly but very incisively, is the importance of the intelligentsia or the intellectual strata in any great social revolution. To do so, I'd like to make a very rigorous distinction between revolutionary ideologues and actual intellectuals who guide the revolution through their sovereign intelligence and through their vision. Ideologues are bad news. Ideologues and demagogues in any revolution, including the current civil uprising in the United States, are bad news. They're going to be co-opted. They're going to be run by the opposition. They're going to be run by the controllers, just as Marx, Trotsky, and Lenin, who were the ideologues of the Russian Revolution, were actually run by the international banking cartel, or their teachings and doctrines were used to create the fiction of communism, which is just a pretext for stealing money from the people and redistributing it to the elite, you see. So beware of ideologues. I'm not talking about the ideologues who stand up in public and pretend to lead the revolution. No. I'm talking about the true intelligentsia of the people, the true intellectuals who carry the spirit of the people, the spirit of mutual aid, as Kropotkin defined it, and the spirit of synergistic anarchy, which was driving the Russian Revolution. That was really the essence of the popular groundswell. And these intellectuals, you can learn about them by name. They were fascinating individuals who had amazing histories and were amazingly creative as writers, poets, artists, and visionaries. The main root of the intelligentsia and the mystically guided individuals behind the Russian Revolution is a person called Nikolai Fedorov, Fedorov, F-E-D-O-R-O-V, Nikolai Fedorov, and you'll find a lot about him in that book, and you can also Google him. Fedorov was the teacher and master of a Russian mystic called Vladimir Soloviev. I mentioned Soloviev in our previous discussions, I believe, didn't I, Fredrix?
Yes, I think you did, the first talk we gave.
Soloviev was like, if I would use the word, the mystical godfather of the Russian Revolution, and he was totally and entirely involved with the Sofianic vision. He had in his soul, in his mystical and spiritual life, direct encounters with an entity that he called the Divine Sophia. And when you look into the groundswell, into the genuine and authentic forces that were driving the Russian Revolution, not the co-opted side of the revolution, but the genuine side, you find that at the base of that groundswell was what I would call the Sophianic mysticism of ancient Russia. The mysticism that saw in the soul of Russia itself the image of the divine feminine. Russians at the dawn of the 20th century actually believed that the country of Russia itself and the Russian people were an instrument of the divine Sophia, and that if that Sophia could awaken and express herself through these people, through this Russian culture, it would transform and save the world. The Pan-Slavic movement, actually, as it was called, actually saw the Russian people and the land of Russia as the salvation of the earth. They actually had that vision. It was a powerful religious vision. Unfortunately, because the Russians had had 1,000 years of very, very brutal brainwashing in Christianity since the 10th century, that vision of Sophia was overlaid by certain layers of Christianity and of Orthodox Greek Christianity. And so you find this element of Orthodox Christianity in Soloviev, in Fedorov, and in other Russian intellectuals and mystics. But you can also see that they were attempting to break through that mental conditioning of Christianity toward actually a resurgence of the pagan spirit of Russia, of the pagan pre-Christian spirit. They didn't succeed in doing that for a number of reasons, mainly two. Although the Russian intelligentsia at the dawn of the revolution had the Sophianic spirit, they had the inspiration of the Divine Sophia as sort of like a lighthouse that was guiding them, they didn't have the story. They didn't have the Gnostic myth of the Sophia in its complete and coherent form as we have it today. And so without the sacred narrative of Sophia, they couldn't really incorporate and effectuate that which they saw happening, which was, in a sense, in a very real sense, according to Fedorov and Soloviev, the incarnation of the divine Sophia, the spirit of wisdom, the Aeon Sophia, her incarnation in the Russian people, in the Russian folk soul. I mean, this is a momentous thing.
And so this was manifest through what you described as synergistic anarchism? Is that
right? Well, synergistic anarchism was the form of social order that these intellectuals wished to achieve. They did not wish to achieve communism in the sense that we understand it under Stalin and later under Khrushchev. They were not inspired toward communism. Communism is a construction of the international banking cartel, which is used to it's a form of duplicity.
What they were thinking of was more of what would be like a mutual cooperative.
Yeah, what Kropotkin said. Kropotkin, Prince Kropotkin, Kropotkin, was a predecessor of the Russian Revolution in the 19th century. He was a brilliant naturalist, equal and superior to Darwin. He refuted Darwin, and he showed that the Darwinian idea of the struggle of the fittest, survival of the fittest, is wrong. We survive, animals survive, everyone survives by mutual aid. And so the anarchistic spirit of mutual aid was married to the mystical vision of the Sophia. And this was the double whammy behind the Russian Revolution. And the reason why it failed was, A, because they did not have the Sophianic narrative to follow like we do today. You need a myth. You need a story to frame your experience. They didn't have her story. It's only been restored very recently. The second reason is because the Bolsheviks and the people who were in charge, or the psychopaths, hated this Sophianic element. You know, it's well known that the Bolsheviks repressed religion and destroyed the Eastern Orthodox churches when they came to power in Russia. And so we have this story, oh, they were so against religion. Well, I'll tell you, they weren't really so much against conventional religion, because Christianity can always be co-opted to the power structure. Christianity has served the power structure loyally for centuries. What they hated was this popular and mystical spirit of the divine feminine that they could not control.
Okay, John, well, that's the end of this segment. When we return, we'll pick it right back up right there. So we are going to continue. We're really getting somewhere here now. I don't want to break stride. So, John, go ahead and pick it right back up where we left off before we went to the break.
Sure. The essential point here in tracing this correlation and parallelism between now and the Russian Revolution is to realize the key role of the intelligentsia. There has to be an intelligentsia in the United States, you know, somewhere. And because without an intelligentsia, without an intellectual class, there will be no direction for the revolution. It will devolve into chaos, and it will serve the aims of the controllers, because they want revolution and they want violent opposition, because they're counting on people turning against each other. So there has to be elucidated violence. I'm talking about this a lot on my series of talks on right action and Gaian ethics, elucidated violence. That means that the violent force of the revolution has to be directed toward the right targets. And so the intellectuals help steer the revolution, and they are the true voices, the authentic voices that steered the Russian Revolution. You can read and learn about these people. It's absolutely fascinating. As I say, you start with Vladimir Soloviev, and then you go to Andrei Bielik and Alexander Blok, who were poets, artists, and novelists who followed him, and other intellectuals such as Gorky, Chernyshevsky, Lunacharsky. These are not the ideologues of communism and Stalinism. You're not going to be going to read ideology. Ideology is not where it's at. It's the real intellectual spirit of people who saw and knew what was going on. And that is what we need today. So, point I'd like to make in pulling all this together is that the groundswell behind the Russian Revolution has the same ingredients that we have today in the groundswell of the uprising in the United States and globally. It has two components. One is the movement and the drive toward a social anarchy of mutual aid, or what I would call synergetic anarchy. One of the drives, one of the elements in this drive is the call for free energy devices that will get us, liberate us from the enslavement of the globalist controllers and the big business people. And you might be interested to find out that in the time of the Russian Revolution and even during the Stalinist era, there was an enormous amount of talk about free energy devices, and there were free energy devices. And Vladimir Vernadsky, V-E-R-N-A-D-S-K-I, who is widely considered the father of atmospheric theory and of a predecessor of Gaia theory, was wild about free energy devices and saw a technological utopia based on these devices. Vernadsky was living between the First and Second World Wars, and he laid the foundations for a lot of what is Gaian theory right now. So it was all present in the time of the Russian Revolution. The elements that we have now were present then. But we have the good fortune of having the total narrative of the Divine Sophia, the sacred story, as a guiding framework, as a myth. And that is the mystical or spiritual perspective of the revolution, possibly, that can complement the sociological perspective of mutual aid and synergetic anarchy. Is that a clear picture?
I believe so. Can I ask you one question? When you speak about these leaders that were the artists and the poets and the painters and such, is that what they were engaged in, was producing art to exemplify their vision? Is that what you're saying, John?
Totally, totally. They lived their vision through their art, through their poetry, through their novels. For instance, Andrei Bielei, B-I-E-L-Y, who was a follower of the Sofianic mystic Soloviev, a close follower. He was also very closely associated with Rudolf Steiner and the anthroposophical movement during a certain period of his life. Well, Andrei Bielei wrote a novel called St. Petersburg. Go and read that novel. It is absolutely astounding. This is a novel that is the equivalent of James Joyce's Ulysses, or a novel by Thomas Mann, or any other great master of the 20th century. These people were masters of poetry, painting, and literature. And in those vehicles of art, they carried forward their vision for society, and they effectuated, as far as they could with their limits, their sense of the Sophianic connection, that is, the connection to Gaia Sophia, who is the living intelligence of the earth.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's really, and so then as a result of that, they spoke to the people, pagan, the country dwelling farmers, the serfs of the Russian class of the time.
Well, what they tried to do, you have to realize again that the serfs of Russia, you know, it was typical for a serf in the Tsarist era to get up in the morning, go into his master and ask to be beaten. Did you ever hear that story?
No. No.
This is a story often repeated by Russian historians. It's a fact. Many of the serfs in Russia at that time were so conditioned to the deplorable enslavement of their lives and to the abuse that was inflicted on them by the authorities and by the owners of the system, that they went to their masters and begged to be beaten. Well, that's exactly what Americans do today. They get up and they turn on the television and they beg to be deceived.
Okay, sure. All right.
They go to the authorities and they beg to be abused. They beg to be abused in order to be protected, because that gives them a perverse sense of protection. They eat poison, they drink poison, they absorb all the poisons and toxins that the authorities put into the atmosphere, and they beg for more. There's a woman recently who was selling her booty on the street for chicken McNuggets. You know, this is the degree of enslavement that the American people have reached, which is exactly parallel to the serfs in the time of the end of the Tsarist regime. So the intellectuals could not really speak to these serfs, but what they did was, because they were too stupid and dumbed down. But what they did was they created what I would call a magnetic front. They were the avant-garde of society, and the avant-garde of society always leads by magnetism, by attraction, not promotion. And so through the attraction of their works of art and of their fantastic personalities, read the lives of these people, they were astounding, they created a magnetic front that drew the popular support to them, even though many of the population of serfs were not educated enough to understand what these intellectuals were actually doing. And that is the role of intellectuals, to create a magnetic front that draws the lesser educated population in the right direction.
But you've made the distinction between the intellectual that does that and the ideologue or the idealist who's just fomenting insurrection. Is that right?
Right. You have to be really careful of ideologues and demagogues and the ones who take the role, who get up on the soapbox and tell us that they are leading the revolution because they are defining the ideas of it. You have to be very careful of those sort of people, because history shows that they are always co-opted and they often work for the controlled opposition.
Okay. And you keep making the call, John, and I agree with you that the direction of the revolution depends on its intellectuals, which we beg this question now in America, which, you know, is seemingly on the verge of civil unrest, social revolution. You know, who are our modern day intellectuals here in America ready to take up that charge and lead the revolution? That's the big question, right, John?
That's right, and I can't answer that question, and neither can you. The only way we will know that is as the revolution unfolds, as the situation cracks open. We will know them by their behavior. We will know them by their fruits and by the way that they behave.
Yeah, absolutely.
And by the way that they represent the spirit of freedom. And I want to point out, do I have like 3 more minutes?
Yes, you do. You have 4 minutes by my record.
Okay, I want to point out a really critical factor that concerns me a lot. When you go back and you look at the Russian Revolution, one of the things that you learn is that there was a massive civil uprising, people versus the Tsar. Today it would be people versus the feds. But then within the people, within the uprising, there was a split. And there was a civil war, and there was a split between the white and the red Russians. And so I anticipate the danger that there will also be a split in the uprising in the United States against federal authority. And that split centers on one key question and one very difficult and tricky issue, and that is the issue of moral authority. So when the authority of the feds, that is the false authority of the dominators and the psychopathic controllers, is refuted and thrown off, people fall back on themselves, and they have to define their moral authority. So where are the true participants in the new American Revolution going to get their moral authority from? Well, unfortunately, I suspect that there may be a very serious split on this issue, because a great many of the people in the civic uprising will get their moral authority from the Bible and from biblical Christianity. As you know, a lot of militia groups, most of them, in fact, are fundamentalist-oriented. But there will be others who will not want to go to the Bible for the moral authority of the new society that's made from the ruins of the dominator system. And they will look more toward pagan, indigenous, and Gaian values for their moral authority. So I think that it is very likely there will be that kind of major rift among those who undertake the civil uprising that is now happening in the United States.
I think that you already can find that polarization, too, by many different names and labels, John, right now, the way you're describing it.
Yeah, I just can only warn people in the strongest possible terms to be really, really careful of reverting to biblical and fundamentalist Christian values, because that is not the way of the future. That system is dead. It's a controller system, just like the governmental authority, and it has to go down in ruins with the controller system. The only true viable morality for the future comes from neo-pagan, indigenous, and Gaian perspectives of spirituality.
I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't agree with you more, John. And that's why we love having you here in the Middle Chamber to speak about this, because you really, you know, I've got a clarity of thought about this. And, you know, it is, it's clear in its own way that these other systems, these dominator systems, are on the decline by their own zero growth, by their own, you know, mass exodus from the ranks of their followers and believers. You know, I mean, it's very clear that the general consensus is that this is the losing paradigm.
Sure. The control game of the global psychopaths is collapsing under its own Byzantine absurdity.
Under the weight of its own Byzantine absurdity, right?
That's right.
Complete with facades and all.
Totally. You know, what did they say recently? FBI considers you a terrorist suspect if you pay for your coffee with cash. I mean, that is Byzantine absurdity.
Well, I haven't heard that
one. Who's going to enforce that? How long is it going to be before every average, even the average person on the street is saying, who gives a damn what the FBI says?
Yeah, the only way that you'll enforce that is just like you said, the self-surveillance populace, the ones who are ratting themselves out, you know?
And there will be people like that, but it's so contrary to the conscience of the American spirit, the conscience of freedom, that I don't really think it's gonna wash.
Okay. Well, John, we'll continue with yet another segment, our final segment of the show, when we come back with John Lash here on Radio Free Humanity. I'm Freighter X. Stay tuned. Okay. I don't know where we're going, but I do know where we have been. We have been here, Radio Free Humanity, in the Middle Chamber with John Lamb Lash from MetaHistory.org. I am your host, Freighter X, and we've been speaking about the occult roots of the Russian Revolution. That was Colston Miller Group playing in the background, yet another friend of the show. Check them out. Check out his Facebook page, Colston Miller Group, and check out his Friends of Freeman page at CB. That's CB at friendshipagenda.com. So, John, just for the record, you're getting an awesome response from the chat. Mater X wanted to let you know that she's really enjoying the subject tonight and really excited about the conclusions that we're coming to, and everybody is really liking it. There's several people here who are all piping up, they're chiming in and really showing their approval for this conversation this evening.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your attention, and I really feel so strongly. I mean, I've been in love with Russia, Russian culture, and totally fascinated and involved with the Russian Revolution since I was 16 years old. And my passion for the Russian people as a counterpart to the American people has never faltered. So what I'd like to do, and just very briefly in the last section, is wrap it up with two points. We're all asking ourselves a question, you know, how can we fight against social evil? And of course, there are many ways we do this. We can do it by non-compliance with the system. We can do it by lawful rebellion, by taking out lawsuits, for instance, as they're being taken out against the TSA, or even the TSA is being thrown out of airports now. They're introducing legislation. So there are many channels in which we can fight social evil. But I would point out again an interesting anecdote from the Stalinist era that might illustrate some two tools of social evil that are against social evil that are particularly effective. You know, Stalin was an absolute monster because he was a total wimp, and the wimps are very, very dangerous, as we know. The wounded man makes the worst tyrant and a genocidal maniac into the bargain. And he ruled, you know, Stalin means iron, man of iron. He ruled Russia with an iron fist. His real name was another name. I can't remember what it is right now. And he kept everyone in Russia as if it was a prison camp, and he created the gulag. Now, there's a parallel today. There are people, global psychopaths, who we understand through Agenda 21 and other programs would like to turn America into a gulag. You see? A Gaza Strip slash gulag. Who wants to turn America into a Gaza Strip slash gulag? Some people do. Some insane, murderous people want to do that. And Stalin actually managed to do that in Russia, and he wouldn't let anybody out. But he did let two people out. Two people. This is an amazing story. And one of those people got a phone call from Stalin. This was absolutely unheard of. He was a writer, and his name was Evgeny Zamyatin. Z-A-M-Y-A-T-I-N. Zamyatin. Evgeny Zamyatin. He was a writer, and Stalin actually called him up. This is unheard of. And told him that he would have free passage to leave Russia. You know why Stalin did that? Because he saw in Evgeny Zamyatin something that his totalitarian system could not defeat. And do you know what that was?
Freedom. Liberty.
No. Satire.
Oh, okay.
Satire. Evgeny Zamyatin was a satirist. He wrote this novel called We, which was a satire of communism. And what Stalin realized, or the intellectuals around him, his handlers realized, was that the government and the feds, with all their paranoid insanity of domination, cannot defeat satire. Satire is a very powerful tool against tyranny. And the only writer who actually left Russia during the Stalinist era was this one novelist, Evgeny Zamyatin. There was a second writer that Stalin was also afraid of, but he did not leave because of various health reasons and because he went blind. And that writer, again, was one of the great novelists of the 20th century. I suggest if any of you out there still read novels, start reading Russian novels. Read St. Petersburg by Andrei Bielik, and read The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, B-U-L-G-A-K-O-V, Bulgakov. Bulgakov was the second person who had the opportunity to slip through the cracks and leave Stalinist Russia. Why? Because he wrote The Master and Margarita, which is one of the most powerful novels of the supernatural ever written. And Stalin was afraid of the real supernatural. The real supernatural. That is the real power of magic. So these two anecdotes, which are extraordinary anecdotes, and historians themselves are baffled by these two cases, illustrate that the power of satire and the power of supernatural magic are indefeatable, and that all tyrants and pathological oppressors are terrified of these two powers. So you might think about those two things when you are considering your tools and weapons against the orchestrations of social evil that we are now facing on this planet.
John, could you elaborate for the listeners, just briefly elaborate on what the form of satire was that this man was engaged in?
Well, basically, in his novel We, which you can buy in English translation, is probably even available online, and in his general handling of politics and the Stalinist regime, he had an immunity. You see, satire and magic are two elements that make us immune to the oppressor and dominator system. Because whereas they can take other aspects of our behavior, they can take all of our needs and our passions and use them against us, they cannot use satire and magic against us. These are sovereign powers. So what Zamyatin did was that he satirized the Stalinist regime in such a manner that he did not necessarily have to come out and attack it directly, because then he could have been refuted or he could have been silenced. But he made it look ridiculous.
Okay.
And when we make the oppressors look ridiculous, which isn't so hard these days because they're making themselves look really ridiculous, you know.
Right.
But when we show them, you know, when the FBI comes to you and you show them that the FBI is ridiculous, that disempowers them. And that is how Zamyatin got this special status in regard to his life living under the worst period of Stalin in the 1930s, you see. So go investigate it yourself. You'll find that it's absolutely fascinating. I encourage everyone to study Russia in the 20th century, to study the Sofianic elements behind the Russian Revolution, to connect with Russia, to get a pen pal in Russia. You know, I'm going to go so far as to say something here that I've never said before, but it's been developing in my soul since I was 16 years old. The Russian people believed at the dawn of the 20th century that Mother Russia was the incarnation of a divine feminine goddess, Sophia, and that she would save the world. They believed that Russia was sociologically the salvation of the world. I would say today that the unity of Russia and America can be the salvation of the world. That Russia and America are really sister souls. Russia is the mother culture of this planet, and America is the heroic culture, and the goddess and the hero go together. And so if you want to see the fulfillment of the myth of the goddess and the hero, which is the great directing myth of humanity, if you want to see it played out on the stage of history, it is played out in the complementarity and unity of Russia and America as sister souls.
Wow, that's huge.
It is.
It's really it's intense to take in.
And it's not something that you need to be convinced of by ideology or any outward form of argument. If you go as an individual, each of you I'm speaking to, if you have the disposition to go and investigate these elements of Russian history that I'm describing, you may connect with them in a way that will really surprise you.
Well, you know, John, I think it's remarkable because what you say, that the hope is there, that the Russian culture would be the hope of the world.
That's right.
Well, I ran out of time, but it was really great talking with you, John. Thank you so much for concluding this subject with us tonight. And remember, everyone, metahistory.org is John's website. And next week we have John Michael Greer here on Radio Free Humanity with Freighter X. Thanks again, and have a good week. We'll see you all next time. Good night.